Ron, when did you first realize that your son Owen was different from other kids?
We had moved to Washington in the fall of 1993. I was moving down to be the senior national affairs writer for the Wall Street Journal, and it was my wife and I, our two children. We have an older son, Walter, who's 2.5 years older than Owen. He was 5. Owen was just 2.5 at that point, our little guy. And he was chatting away at 2.5. I love you, let's get ice cream, the normal 2.5-year-old speech. And then he started to lose speech rather dramatically and quickly. In about 2 months, he was down to one word, juice, one word, and was quite inconsolable. He was crying a lot. He was not sleeping. He couldn't make eye contact. And at that point, we were terrified, and we sought out specialists.
Wow. And Owen was eventually diagnosed with regressive autism. What do we know about this disorder?
Well, regressive autism is very much like traditional, let's say, autism. It's genetically coded. There may be some environmental trigger, just like lots of autism. We don't know really the cause so much. But it comes later. So the kids seem typical often in the first year or two. And then somewhere between usually 18 and 36 months, they regress, as it says. And that's startling for the parents, just like it was for us. You have videos of them at 2, and they're smiling and they're laughing, and then they're not. And those videos are ones we eventually couldn't watch.
Do you remember that first day that you got the diagnosis of regressive autism?
Oh, sure. 20 years ago now, but it feels like it was last Tuesday. You can remember it that vividly. And in some ways, what it is it's because the people who, sitting in that chair, as the doctor says, autism, you know, they froze in place and you start to float above them. The first step of the new people that will emerge, you can't hardly breathe when you hear that at the beginning. You're like, well, what is that? All we knew was Rain Man, of course. Well, mostly anyone knows. And then they explain, look, he may never get his speech back. Many of them don't. You need to think about supporting him for the next 50 years and 30 years after you're dead, probably. And your life will now be different, all of your lives, your whole family.
So you realized at that moment that that your life was going to be transformed.
Yeah. You know, over the coming months, certainly, you know, one doctor, very nice guy, said to me, so what is it you do for a living? I said, I'm a newspaper reporter. He says, oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. He's a lovely guy. I said, well, why? He says, are you good with numbers? I said, you know, Mets and Mets. He says, you know, private equity, very nice field these days. Investment banking, you should consider.
As in, this is going to be a very expensive treatment.
Oh, we couldn't have known. But yes, he was trying to help me. He's like, you're a young guy. Maybe a career shift now would be advisable. So, no, I said, all I can do is write stories. And that's my career. Sorry.
Yeah. Now, a big part of this story with Owen is the fascination he developed for Disney films, which has proved to be life-changing. But when you first saw this, when you saw how much he loved watching Disney films, were you kind of worried?
Well, sure. You know, I mean, he liked them like other kids did before the onset of the autism. And his big brother, Walt, you know, 2.5 years older, they all watched them. They watched them a lot. You know, this is a big golden era for Disney, making something of a comeback. You know, Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, The Lion King. Those were huge movies in those years. But there was a change after the autism because he was watching them with a kind of intensity. Now, remember, he's not speaking at this point. And so we wondered. We asked our doctors, is this all right? And they said, well, is he joyful? We said, he seems to be. He seems to be comfortable. Okay. Well, he's not comfortable almost anywhere else, so it's all right. Don't stop it. He can do this during some free hours. And then we start to see he's looking at them with enormous intensity. And then we start to realize something may be going on here.
When did he talk again? When was the next time?
Well, you know, the first moment where we are startled is over the months, as he has stopped speaking and when he's 4 years old. You know, he's murmuring some gibberish. You know, he's saying Juicervos, Juicervos, and like a baby, you know, murmurs gibberish because he had no other speech. And And we're watching a movie that he was clearly into at this point, watching it silently, his eyes alight, called The Little Mermaid. And we're all up in the bedroom because this is really the only family activity we can do together. And this part where Ariel, the protagonist, has to trade her voice to become human. And, of course, the sea witch, the villain, says, "It won't cost you much, just a trifle, really, just your voice." And Cornelia, we thought he'd been saying, "I want more juice." And she was giving him juice, juicervos. She says, "It's not juice, it's just." And all of a sudden we see it on the screen, just your voice. And I grab him and I say, "Oh my God, just your voice." And he's saying, "Juicervos, juicervos, juicervos." And this is a moment. Walter's brother starts jumping on the bed. Owen's talking again. This is what we called our Annie Sullivan, Helen Keller moment. Now, of course, the doctors brought us in and sat us down again. You know, this is an education process. And they said, look, this may seem miraculous, but this is called echolalia. The kids who lose speech, like Owen, often develop this, just like what it sounds, echo. They echo noise. I said, so he doesn't know what the words mean. They said, probably not, because the processing, auditory processing, the way you process speech in your brain, goes haywire often for autistic kids when this happens. So we were brought down to earth again, bucket of cold water. This goes on for some years, where he seems to be verbalizing noises and scripts from the movies, little bits of a few words or a bit of dialogue.
And then something else happened, wasn't it, on Walter's ninth birthday, his brother's ninth birthday.
Absolutely.
And Owen talked again.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And his brother, of course, is a traditional sibling of a disabled kid. He's wildly independent, a junior adult at a very young age. And of course, our story, Cornelia and my story about Walter, is, you know, there's nothing he can't handle. He's a master of his world. And the key thing is he won't ever leave his brother behind. That's what we wanted to see. So we don't much notice that Walter gets emotional on only one day of the year, his birthday. And after this happens on his ninth birthday, Owen, who's saying virtually nothing at this point, a few words, follows us into the kitchen, looks at us intently, and says, "Walter doesn't want to grow up like Mowgli or Peter Pan."
Wow.
Now, this is like a thunderbolt went through the kitchen. Owen is 6 and a half at this point. You know, he's barely said much, you know, three-word sentences, "I want juice, give me the ball." And now he's offered a complex sentence of a very complex and nuanced thought. Now, at this moment, you know, he runs off in his private reverie, Owen, whatever he's thinking. And Cornelia and I don't stop talking for 4 hours. You know, how do we get back in? You know, it's like a window opened and we could see him again. And so that night, I go up to his bedroom and I grab one of his puppets. He seemed very intent on a movie called Aladdin. The villain is Jafar, the evil vizier of Agrabah. His villainous sidekick is Iago, the parrot. Well, the parrot puppet is sitting on the floor of Owen's bedroom. I put it on. I crawl up to the edge of the bed. Owen's looking at a book, oblivious to me. And I push the puppet up through the edge of the bedspread. And I talk to him in the voice of Iago. That's, of course, Gilbert Gottfried's voice. Anyone can do it. It's like a busted Cuisinart. And so I say, "Owen, Owen, Owen, how does it feel to be you?" And he turns to the puppet like he's bumping into an old friend. And he says, "Not good. I have no friends and I'm lonely." And this is our first conversation. Now, of course, I bite down hard, you know, say, "Oh, God, don't get emotional here. You've got to stay in character." And I think, what would Iago say next? And so I say, "Oh, so when did you and I become such good friends?" And he says, "When I watched Aladdin and you made me laugh." And we talk, Owen and Iago, the evil puppet. And then after a few minutes, I hear Owen seeming to clear his throat, and he answers back, "I love the way your foul little mind works." Now, that would be Jafar, the villain. And that's the way things went then. A conversation begins between a villain and his evil sidekick. Now, at that point, the Susskind family, the household, turns upside down. Cornelia and I realize he must have memorized all of these scripts and the dialogue and the lyrics, mostly as sound. And if you throw him a line, he'll throw you back the next line. And then you'd be ready with the next one.
But the thing is, it wasn't just this sort of repeating words. I mean, there was meaning here.
Well, that was our question. How much does he understand? Well, over time, we realized that he was understanding more and more. Because we would play out the scenes, and it wasn't just mimicry. He seemed to be channeling the emotions of the characters. And so this begins what we called the basement sessions in our house, where we played out scenes from all the Disney movies, about 20 of them that were clearly Owen's special favorites. And everyone joined in, his older brother, Cornelia, me, and we became Disney characters. So here we were living a traditional Washington life. Cornelia's driving Owen to every therapy session she can find. Walter's going to school. I'm going to the Wall Street Journal Bureau every day. But at night, we become animated characters. Over years, this is how he gets his speech back, little by little.
So part of the story is trying to figure out what was going on. And you worked with a whole team of professionals, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, an educational specialist, a neuropsychologist. Could any of them explain why Owen could connect in this kind of role playing when he was having so much trouble just in an ordinary conversation?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, these are called affinities, and virtually every child on the autism spectrum, and now, you know, it's one out of every 68 kids, one out of every 42 boys in America, which is astonishing, 2.5% of the male population. They each have something, and we've met many of them. It could be Thomas the Tank Engine. It could be anime. It could be maps, trains. Disney's very big. There's no doubt about it. It could be black and white movies from the 40s and 50s. Find that sweet spot is what we found. But frankly, these affinities were mostly seen as non-productive, obsessive engagements, a thing to be reduced. And either reduced or used as a behavioral tool, meaning say to the kid, if you want to watch that video, here are 10 things you have to do, each of them like walking across hot coals. There have been some gains using them as behavioral props or tools. But what we found is when we did that with Owen and we tried everything, it seemed like he might have a little spike in some behaviors. He would try to act more like other kids or try to listen better to his teachers. But it would trail off quickly, almost like we were cutting off his supply line. And at that point, we said, we just have to live and love his affinity, respect it, live within it, enjoy it with him. And eventually, we hope he'll let us in deeper and deeper, which is what he does. This is going against virtually all of the thinking about these affinities, which have always been the elephant in the room about autism for many years. Reduce them, control them. We said, love them, engage with them, because that's where Owen's identity was living.
Do we know why? Or do the experts, the so-called experts, know why? I mean, why could he relate to these imaginary characters in a way that he had so much trouble relating with the people in his family?
Well, you know, it's one of these things that we find. They're just exactly like you and me, just more so and less so. Now, the less so parts are very visible, often separating them from the wider world in a traditional life. The more so parts are often subtle, opaque, hidden, like lights hidden under bushel baskets. The fact is that all of us are into movies. This is the way we live these days, with moving images and voices in our heads. Owen is dramatically more so, because in some ways, he has to live almost exclusively on this diet of myth, fable, and legend, is carried largely by animated movies. So when you see this kind of extreme, you have a difficult question to ask yourself. Is it passion or is it obsession? And try to draw that line with a kid who naturally can't engage with much else. Difficult to do. So we start seeing it as pathway rather than prison. And our specialists, we have a wonderful team of specialists. Eventually, they start to come around little by little because this goes against the accepted orthodoxy for certainly the last several decades. And once they see it, they engage, especially one particular therapist who got right in there with us doing the voices and really playing the characters.
So you had to, so this is what you did for years
Oh, sure, yeah.
To play these characters.
Yeah.
Your whole family did.
Yeah, my whole family. Yeah. I mean, you know, of course, I lived a public life otherwise. I was writing books and about presidents, interviewing them, wrestling with them in public on television shows. And then I led this other life. So one day I'd be talking about George Bush and Dick Cheney, and the next day I'd be in the basement meditating on evil with Owen about which villain was the most pernicious and evil. And we even at one point talked about Bush and Cheney, where Owen was trying to make connections. I said, don't go there, buddy. Don't go there.
Now, there's something else that Owen did. I mean, the way you write about it is he developed a fascination for the sidekick characters in some Disney films. Why were they so important to him?
Well, it's interesting. You know, he starts to use these characters, these tropes, these narratives in a much more improvisational way when he turns around 11. And part of it are the sweet uses of adversity. He kind of got whacked at that age. He was asked to leave a school where he'd been for 5 years because, you know, they said he was uneducable, mostly learning disabled kids, dyslexic kids, ADHD kids. A few kids on the spectrum were there. But Owen was out, and he was really bruised, and we knew that. He couldn't really say very much at 11 in terms of expressive speech, but we could see he was quite upset. So he goes down to the basement, his underground lair, and he starts to become an aficionado of the sidekicks. Now, of course, every hero has them. As Owen will tell you, they help the hero fulfill his destiny. And Owen, at this point, seeing for the first time the wider world that other kids are racing forward, he's caught in the starting blocks, feels like a sidekick himself and becomes an expert on hundreds of them in the Disney pantheon. You know, some are goofy, some are confused, some are resourceful, some are wise. And each of them speaks to Owen in ways that he can hear. He himself feels like a sidekick. And he becomes somebody who gives sidekick identities to, well, me and Cornelia, the two. kids at school, some of them heavily burdened with physical disabilities, some with no speech. And he starts to draw furiously at this point. It's almost like a little light went off in his head. And he begins to draw, looking at a Disney book, he can draw the picture almost exactly. At which point I find a first pad, and it looks just like the animation department at Disney drew it. And at the end of the pad, I realize that it's all sidekicks, 100 sidekick pictures, no heroes. And at the end, two things are written in a kindergartner's scrawl, because he can't write very well at that point. And one is, I am the protector of the sidekicks. And the last line is, no sidekick gets left behind. And in a way, he has created an emotional language from the scripts and the characters so he can express what's in his heart.
Just to hear you just tell the story, I mean, it almost sends chills down my spine. I mean, it's like you're describing a kid who, you know, really couldn't talk, couldn't articulate, and then suddenly he comes out with these profound things.
You know what? Here's what we find. You know, Owen now is almost 23, just turned 23, and we know lots and lots of kids that we've met over the years with affinities that are quite deep. And when they're nourished, when they're encouraged, we find surprising things occur, that they are doing things not dissimilar to what Owen does. It's often not recognized because there's kind of no place for it in either therapy or education. But, you know, they're creating a language. Some kids speak map. Some kids speak train schedule. Some kids speak anime. But they're using it to find their way in the world. And this is the great the lesson that Owen teaches us. Owen's older brother, Walter, says it best. He says, Owen is my best teacher. And in some ways, that's part of what happened. We worldwise folks, like me and my wife, you know, I've taught at famous colleges and all of that mumbo jumbo. Owen has been our teacher. A kid, mind you, with a measurable IQ of 75. And to put IQ scores on these kids, there should be a law against that. But he's got that tattoo to his arm, like many kids do, because they are so untraditional in how they express their essence, their ability, that they get discarded. And for Owen, that means here's a mop, mop till you die and be happy. We're actually finding a powerful counterpoint to that. And now specialists are joining us. Leading autism researchers are saying, you know, these affinities are actually more pathway, we think, than prison.
So you're saying that Owen's story has actually changed the way people, the so-called experts, think about autism and what to do about it?
I sit here surprised to report this. I am an investigative reporter. I am skeptical of everything. But that, in fact, is the case. We've met with various experts, leading experts in autism, for the past year. And since the book came out, they have been joined by others. There's now a new study being launched by MIT and Yale and Cambridge University. Duke University is jumping in too, it seems, to say we need to reverse the telescope. Look, not much has worked in terms of helping to educate or bring therapy to many folks on the autism spectrum. It's very frustrating for parents, for therapists. And I think we may be at an inflection point where this kind of blind spot or elephant in the room, whichever you prefer, about these affinities may be a key unlocking great potential. By virtue of the affinity, through the affinity, you can see heightened capabilities otherwise invisible for many of the kids, and that may lead to better possibilities in their lives, which is something everybody wants.
I would think the big question would be whether Owen could sort of move from this role-playing fictional world, dealing with these imaginary characters from Disney films, whether that translates to the real world and actually how he interacts with other people. Did that happen?
Well, you know, it's interesting because it's really happened just in the last 3 years. He left home 3 years ago to go to a college-like program on Cape Cod for folks with various challenges, many of them on the autism spectrum. And, of course, the first thing he does when he gets there, he starts Disney Club because he needs friends. He's often been friendless, and now he says, I need to find friends. And Cornelia and I, my wife and I, visit. At that point, I was the writer-in-residence at the Kennedy School. We drive the hour from Harvard Square to Cape Cod, and there's 12 kids in the room just like Owen, and they're all speaking Disney to each other. And as they do it, they're finding themselves in a deep shared context. This is an important word because autistic kids and many untraditional folks are often called context blind. They don't pick up social cues. It makes it very hard to live in the world. Here, though, they're context deep in the shared context of their affinity. And when that happens, they seem settled. And actually, what we find over the years is all sort of social threads start to build, and they start to tie together in relationships. Owen has a girlfriend in Disney Club. Her name's Emily. She's a Dumbo girl. She didn't speak as a little kid. Many of the folks who did not speak when they were young bond with non-speaking characters, we find, because, of course, Pluto, Dumbo, they express all emotions without words. And Disney Club now is a kind of place of celebration. There are about 35 kids in it. They recite the dialogue. They talk to one another about their expertise of Disney. And it's beyond even what Cornelia and I have. Of course, we've watched every movie until you want to jump out a window. And it's very heartening because they have found a community of shared purpose and shared affinity. And from there, relationships are growing quickly.
You're talking about developing friendships. And it raises all kinds of profound questions about what it means to have a friend.
You know, it's a question Owen has asked us from time to time. You know, is friendship forever? You know, what does it mean to be a friend? You have to be a friend to have a friend. And you know, it's interesting because the Disney movies, whatever you think of them, actually have a kind of, you know, somewhat unnoticed history. There are stories, folklore, that many go back thousands of years. The Brothers Grimm took them. Disney takes them. Stories that human beings have been telling themselves for all time to help us figure out who we are and make our way in the world. Joseph Campbell certainly would say that if he were alive today. And I think it's interesting that Owen and his peers know this. In some ways, they were never taught differently. And from that, they embrace these moral precepts because every one of the movies has one. Beauty lies within, be true to yourself, love lasts forever. And what Owen does is he tests those really venerable concepts of the human pageant out in the world every day. in the world of Shades of Grey, and that's the tension in his life. But it's one that has yielded forward progress for he and many kids like him. It's a very exciting moment for so many parents who have heard this story, have called us. We have thousands of emails at this point, and not just from the therapists and the specialists, but from parents saying, you know, I suspected this too, but I was told that I should go in the other direction. And now this is, in a way, freeing me to go with my instincts as a parent. And that's a very exciting, exciting moment, really.
So when you think about Owen's future now, are you worried, concerned, hopeful?
You know, we will always be concerned. He is autistic. He will always be autistic. This is not a spell that gets broken. It's a way of being. And the challenges keep coming. But, you know, I think we are more hopeful than we ever could have imagined, because what we're finding is that he has built a toolkit from his own special affinity and, of course, from the love and support of the family and his friends and the therapists, where he's able to sort of make his way, at least more and more without us. Someday it will be without us. And we can see a time where that will work out okay. And he has his brother, who recently in an interview said, look, I can see someday I'll be 70 and Owen will be 68 and he'll live near me. You know, I'll check up on him and see him all the time. And at that point, Walter's confident they'll be talking about a lot more than just Disney. They're already doing some of that.
Can you explain what is involved in this Disney therapy?
Oh, sure. You know, I think part of it is the Disney therapy, or now what we call affinity therapy, because there's so many affinities you can use this on. The key is to handle it carefully. It's like a piece of china. You know, you don't want to barge in, because the kid is really relying on this. So you go in gently. You don't knock over any furniture or break the vase, and you sit with them. And slowly you try to do things that they're doing. It could be just a noise, a verbalization, even something that's not language, how they look, how they act. You dance in front of the screen with them, and you show comfort in this place of shared context. Soon, what we found, and others as well, is that you're going to start to see little threads of connections start to form. Over time, it grows wider and deeper. And if you respect the affinity, you're going to have a chance to see more. They'll bring you in deeper. And then together, you can start building a vehicle that eventually they will be able to drive. We hope, in many cases we found this, in the wider world. You know, once it started to take shape, it grew in many directions. Owen started to use his wise sidekicks, Merlin, Rafiki, Sebastian from The Little Mermaid, as advisors. it's something that autistic kids are not supposed to have. It's called inner speech. Most typical people develop it around the time you're 3 years old. Before that, you're verbalizing as a two-year-old, saying everything out loud. Then you start talking sort of internally, thinking things through. It leads to executive function. It helps you navigate the world. Autistic kids are not supposed to do that, but it seems through Owen's therapists and what they've seen that he's developed inner speech using the scripts and a kind of internal conversation with his favorite characters. And that helps him as he moves forward. That's a kind of therapy. Disney therapy and affinity therapy that is making us more hopeful than we ever thought we'd be. And other people are trying it. And so, look, this is a pretty tough terrain we live on. You know, autism is spreading. We don't know why. There's so many families that are burdened. I mean, the costs are crushing. Many of those costs are not covered by insurance. It's really a crisis. But this is a ray of some hope. It's like Leonard Cohen says in that song, it takes a crack. It's the crack through which the light shines, and we may have found one here.
Yeah. This is an amazing story. Thank you for telling it.
Well, thanks for talking. It's been very lovely. Thanks.